Please rise. The Missouri Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Ross, Judge Bratfold, the Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Good morning. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. It's first day of May 2019. We're ready for arguments in the first case on this morning's calendar in the matter of the civil commitment of Stephen Lauren Edwards. Would counsel for appellant please approach the podium and state your name for the record before beginning your argument.
Good morning, Your Honors. Brandon Basie, Assistant Attorney General on behalf of the appellant, the Commissioner of Human Services. May it please the court. The Judicial Appeal Panel erred when it granted respondents petition for transfer to MSOP's less restrictive unlocked facility community preparation services. The panel erred by relying on a single witness's testimony whose opinion was based on beliefs that were not supported by the evidence as a whole. The Judicial Appeal Panel's decision should be reversed and respondents' petition for transfer to community preparation services should be denied. This court reviews findings of fact for the Judicial Appeal Panel for clear error, for clear error. And while it reviews for findings of fact for clear error, it does review the application of facts to the law in a de novo matter.
Counsel, I want to focus a little bit on the standard of review in this case. I see that you indicate it is de novo. What does that mean to you? What are you suggesting we would do de novo in this case?
To clarify, Your Honor, I would say that our appellant's position is that the findings of fact are reviewed for clear error.
Okay.
But the application of the facts to the law is reviewed de novo. And that's been set out in, I think, in well-established case law. Most recently, I think, the Kirchhoff decision, an unpublished case from this court.
Let me ask you this. Do you have any published authority or Minnesota Supreme Court authority saying that this court applies the standard for a reduction of custody to the facts found by the Judicial Appeal Panel de novo?
Yes, Your Honor. I apologize, but let me just.
Is it the Krupp case you're looking for?
Or I think the Krupp case discusses that, Your Honor. I think the Fugelseth case, I think, probably discusses that.
The reason I'm asking the question is because I think I've read all of the cases that discuss the standard of review and understand its progression over time. I'm wondering if there is any case other than Kirchhoff where a court has both said application of statutory standard to undisputed facts is reviewed de novo and actually then engaged in de novo review in arriving at a decision.
I'm personally not aware explicitly. I think that this court does that frequently, though, at least implicitly. There's a number of cases that are appealed, both by the commissioner and by individuals who are civilly committed. I think this court is well aware that there are a number of appeals mm-hmm. that come before the court on civil commitment reductions in custody.
Well, and I've read a number of those decisions, and a number of those decisions seems to say, well, the evidence as a whole either does or does not support the panel's decision. And that, to me, doesn't seem like de novo review. That seems to allow some sort of deference to the panel's reasoning. I mean, in my view, de novo review would look like this. We would evaluate the findings of fact for clear error. We would give some deference to credibility determinations made by the panel. But at the end of the day, if we disagreed with the panel, we could reverse even if the evidence supported the panel's decision. Is that your understanding of what de novo review would look like?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I think that this court is an error correcting court, and so I think it's this court's responsibility to correct errors. And so I do not disagree. I know that respondent cites case law that, you know, if reasonable minds could come to two separate opinions, that this court's responsibility is to affirm. I think, however, where the de novo review comes in, Your Honor, is that if the panel just makes clearly erroneous findings of fact,
okay,
and then those findings of fact are the only evidence that are in the record that would support a petition, if we get rid of those findings of fact, then this court has to do a de novo review of what is left in the record and what is left that was found.
Is that a de novo review, though? Because to me, it sounds like what you're proposing is what's described in the earlier case law and the Supreme Court case law, which is we look at the findings of fact that aren't erroneous, as well as the credibility determinations, and ask whether the record as a whole supports the panel's decision. If it does, we affirm, even though we might disagree with it. If it doesn't, we reverse. Is that how you believe this works?
Your Honor, I think that what the commissioner's position is that the application of the facts to the law is a legal determination, and this court reviews legal determinations de novo. I think that's...
As I understand it, the standard for a transfer is you can't order a transfer unless it's appropriate. That's the standard. Is this appropriate? Then there are factors that must be considered. But unlike the statutory definitions for SDP or SPP, where you must find these certain things before you could conclude that someone is SDP or SPP, that's not how this transfer decision works. Is it appropriate? You must consider these things. The statute doesn't say you can't consider other things. It seems to be a balancing of factors, which involves some fact-finding, some credibility determination, but at the end of the day, an exercise of some discretion. If that's the process, I'm having a hard time understanding why that is a legal determination compared to, for example, is this case time-barred under a statute of limitation? Or was there a constitutional violation? The types of things we typically call de novo review. In other words, there are issues of law such that this court can substitute its judgment for the lower tribunal, even though we're an error-correcting court. And that's a struggle I'm having. Is this decision that we're reviewing really one in which this court should be able to substitute its judgment for the judicial appeal panel, even if the judicial appeal panel's decision is supported by correct facts and credibility determinations that find some support in the record?
Your Honor, I think with respect to transfer, I think that... So we cite a case called the Potier case.
Mm-hmm.
It's 490 Northwest 2nd 915. And in that case, I believe that was a transfer case. It was a while ago, in an MIND case, I believe. But that court was a reversal of a transfer based on findings of fact that were clearly erroneous. And so I think it is this court's responsibility as an error.
It's a slightly different question, though. I mean, whether it's clearly erroneous is a matter of law. We can look at the facts and say that there are clear errors, and therefore the findings are unsubstantiated. Let me ask it a different way. Would you agree that it's possible for a case to have findings that could go either way, that could support a decision to grant the transfer petition request, and also could support denying? Would you agree there are circumstances that could occur, findings that could go either way?
I think so, Your Honor, yes.
So what then would this court do in that situation?
In that situation, I think that this court would have to affirm.
Okay, so there is... All right, so how would the de novo aspect of our review apply in that situation?
I think the de novo...
What would we say in affirming?
I think that in the de novo review would be that there is still evidence to support these various factors. If we eliminate the erroneous facts, and this court still believes that there is still evidence in the record to support the various factors that the panel must consider for transfer, if that's the case, if there's still some support,
okay,
then I believe that it would be proper for the court to affirm.
So in that case, we're, without calling it that, we're essentially applying an abuse of discretion standard.
I think the commissioner would disagree.
I mean, what you've just described is exactly the process we would undertake when we're applying that standard in other settings.
I guess I with I think that the way that the case law has come out as far as the de novo review in this area of law, I think I would acknowledge that with transfer it's a little bit more difficult on the de novo review.
Well, whatever we call it, it sounds like you are agreeing that if the facts as found by the panel would support either granting or denying the petition in this case, the request to transfer in this case, we would affirm.
I believe that that would be correct under this court's prior case law. Your Honor, but with respect, I don't think that
Can I ask you a factual question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Can phase three treatment, is the phase three treatment that was never obtained in this case available in the CPS setting?
Yes. Phase three is available in either CPS or his current setting at MSOP Moose Lake. With respect, Your Honor, the questions that this court's posed as far as whether there would be evidence to support transfer, putting aside the erroneous findings of fact, I think isn't present in this case. So in this case, Your Honor, the court, it's a little bit difficult to tell what the court actually found as persuasive. The court simply said that it adopted or that it found Dr. Tippett's, the risk assessor's opinion to be well supported. But it appears that that opinion was based on three primary underlying opinions. The first being that that he would receive reintegration opportunities in the community if he were to be transferred because, in her opinion, he needed that. And the evidence simply did not show that at the hearing. It was undisputed that as a phase two client, he would not receive reintegration opportunities if he were to be transferred.
Well, that's why I was asking you whether phase three was available. So if phase three is available and he completes phase two while he's at CPS, then he would be able to participate in integration processes.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So is there anything in the record that would lead the panel to conclude that as a matter of fact, that scenario is impossible?
No, I don't think that it's impossible. And in fact, I think that that's what everyone hopes that he does, is that Mr. Edwards can get to a point in treatment where he progresses through the program, he can make it to phase three, he can...
So why wouldn't that be so I'm not sure I understand your argument then as to the challenge to that underlying premise, to the testimony that there could be integration processes at CPS available to Mr. Edwards.
Your Honor, if that's the standard, if eventually he might receive treatment or receive reintegration opportunities, it would be the case that every individual at MSOP should go to CPS because eventually they'll progress.
I was just speaking to your challenge that there's no. You're suggesting that it was clearly erroneous for the panel to credit the opinion that Mr. Edwards would be able to avail himself of these integration services. And the basis was that you can't get those services until you have phase three treatment. But it sounds like you're acknowledging that phase three treatment may occur at CPS.
At some unknown point in the future, correct, Your Honor.
Why does it matter? Is there some standard of law that says that integration services have to be available the moment a client arrives at CPS in order for the panel to credit that or to put weight on that possibility?
Your Honor, the statutory criteria that the panel looks at and that this court is reviewing, one of those criterion is that it's looking at the individual's present treatment needs, not some treatment that he might need in the future.
And he presently needs phase two treatment in order to get to phase three treatment.
Correct, and the testimony in the record shows that this individual is only about 15% through phase two, and so he isn't at a point where he's even close to phase three.
Does the record show that he's, as I understood it, that despite his lack of participation in treatment in the past, that he's increased the frequency of treatment leading up to the hearing in this case. Do I read the record correctly or not?
Correct. About a month or month and a half before the hearing in this case, he re-engaged in treatment after a hiatus of about a year and a half. In the 3 years leading up to the hearing in this case, he was sporadically participating, and when he did participate, it was only about 25% of the time. He would attend 25% of the modules, and then in, I think it was April or May of 2017, he stopped participating completely.
Does the record tell us how long it would take a client to complete phase two treatment after, in Mr. Edwards' shoes, as to where, how far he is in the process, if he diligently applies himself?
There's no evidence in the record, Your Honor, as far as a specific length of time, and I think treatment's a fluid a thing, so each individual treatment might take longer for someone else, depending on how well they're engaged and how well they aren't, whether they're being forthcoming and whether they aren't being forthcoming. And Your Honor, I think what's important
to... How could we reverse on that basis if we don't know that it takes an extraordinary amount of time, for example, to complete phase two?
Your Honor, because this court is looking at his present treatment needs, and Dr. Tippett's opinion was said that he should go to CPS in order to get community reintegration. That was the treatment present need that she thought. And that present treatment need is just not something that his treatment team agrees with or that's available for him. And Your Honor, I see that I'm out of time, so I'll come back on rebuttal. But with respect, the appellant would ask that this court reverse the panel's decision. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, Jennifer Tone. I'm the attorney for Stephen Edwards, the respondent in this matter. Interesting questions from the court this morning, and actually that was kind of the way that I had intended to start out my argument, that I think very admittedly there are facts in this record where the panel could have denied Mr. Edwards' request for transfer. I acknowledge that. But there also is sufficient facts in the record to support the panel's granting of Mr. Edwards' request for transfer in this case.
So do you think we should decide de novo whether or not he gets the transfer, or do you think that we're obligated to give some deference to the decision that was made?
I believe that you should give the deference to the panel's decision in this case. I think there's a lot of case law that says this court reviews for clear error. Just because there's a reasonable basis that the panel could have reached a different conclusion does not mean that the panel was obligated to reach that conclusion. It doesn't amount to clear error.
Well, explain the de novo aspect, because there is plenty of case law that does suggest a de novo review. So what is your take on it as to what the meaning of de novo is in this setting?
And I agree with everybody's assessment. I think it is quite unclear and confusing. I guess in the sense that I was looking at it, I think that the panel first reviews the findings of fact for clear error. If the findings are determined to be clearly erroneous, they're essentially set aside, and we look at what's remaining. And when you read the language of the statute, it probably is more of an abuse of discretion, because you take those remaining findings of fact that are supported by the record and, as a matter of law, apply them to the factors that the panel is to consider when it's deciding whether or not transfer is appropriate. So I think it probably really is more of abuse of discretion as opposed to de novo, but I do acknowledge that the case law says de novo review. But that simply doesn't make sense when you consider the fact that this court is not a fact-finding court, in the sense that on appeal we don't reweigh or relitigate the facts in the case. I think when you look at all of the evidence in this case, the judicial appeal panel did what it was obligated to do. It gets to determine who is credible, who is not credible, and it gets to make the findings of fact. And when you look at the order, clearly the panel found that Dr. Tippett's opinion was more credible than Dr. Kenning and Mr. Puffer's opinion.
Or at least more persuasive.
More persuasive.
I question the word credible. That because, I mean, they could have said Dr. Kenning was credible and Dr. Tippett's was credible, but Tippett's was more persuasive.
Certainly. I would agree with that. I would agree. And I think the panel has the unique opportunity to actually observe the witness's demeanor in court when you're making that credibility persuasiveness determination. We're not just looking at what words do the witnesses speak and what words show up on the transcript when we're doing these reviews. It's also about demeanor. And the panel is in that unique position to both hear all of the evidence that's presented and observe the demeanor of each of those witnesses. And ultimately, it's in the best position to make those credibility and persuasiveness determinations. This isn't simply a numbers game. Because we have two opinions that, although consistent, reach a similar opinion, and one opinion that is the outlier that reaches the different opinion. This isn't a numbers game. Two against one doesn't win.
Well, there's, that may be so, but it's what's undisputed, I think, and can't be disputed, is that Mr. Edwards has not really participated in treatment.
There's no requirement that he participate in treatment. When we look at the factors, we're looking at what his treatment needs are. It doesn't say that he needs to presently be participating. I think when you are looking at the psychologists who make these opinions, they're reviewing thousands of pages of records, they're interviewing clients. It's a complex analysis that they engage in. And that's one of the factors that Dr. Tippett, in this case, specifically considered and weighted and put into the formulation of her opinion.
Dr. Tippett said he doesn't have a sexual disorder.
Correct.
He doesn't need sexual treatment. But Dr. Kenning and others said, well, he's got antisocial personality disorder. That was at the root of his offending. He still needs to do some work on that. And if that's a record, doesn't that lead to the conclusion that he does need more treatment to address the behaviors that caused him to offend? And then we have even Tibbetts agreeing that he's at a higher risk of reoffense on current actuarial scores. I mean, I'm having a hard time understanding how Dr. Tibbetts can so readily say, move him on to the next phase where there's less supervision, less control, less security, when he's not doing a great job where he is.
So I think there's kind of two parts to that question. With respect for the treatment piece of it, Dr. Tippett did acknowledge readily that he still has remaining treatment needs. And, you know, I think the way I understood her testimony, I think you have kind of two different individuals in these types of cases. You have ingrained sex offenders that commit sex offenses because they're sexually deviant. And then you have criminals who commit sex offenses. And I think that's kind of what Dr. Tippett was getting at, is that Mr. Edwards is a criminal who committed a sex offense. So that happened. It's part of his history.
Well, not just a sex offense, multiple sex offenses.
Sure, Your Honor. He's got two convictions and two allegations.
He admitted one of the allegations.
He admitted one of the allegations, denied one, and produced a non-deceptive full disclosure polygraph regarding those offenses. But when you're looking at that behavior occurred, it's a treatment need. Dr. Tippett acknowledges that. And when CPS provides the exact same treatment that MSOP Moose Lake provides, that treatment need can be addressed in either location. And when you're
looking, what about his behaviors? I mean, we have, he's aggressive, he's yelling at people, he's yelling at his therapist, he's threatening people. I mean, is there a legitimate concern that if that's how he's behaving now, if you put him in an environment where there are less controls and less security, there are greater risks that might result from his behavior?
I think the evidence shows that he's verbally aggressive. He's kind of a jerk. It's a treatment need. It's something he needs to continue working on. He's not engaging in sexually inappropriate behavior. He's not getting in physical altercations.
There's no evidence of physical confrontation.
That's my recollection of the record. And CPS, if you look at the testimony from Michelle Sexy, the operations director for that facility, there's still a large amount of security there. It's not as if we're letting him go into the community without supervision. You know, there is no razor wire fence, but there's still cameras in common areas, GPS bracelets. There's a lot of rules and structure that is associated with CPS, and there's not a lot of contact with the general public.
And if he violates rules there, what is the process for returning him to the more secure setting?
I believe it's the executive director under the statute that can revoke his placement and send him back to the secured facility.
And then he could have a hearing challenging that.
Correct. Correct. Yep. You know, going back a little bit to the sexuality need, Dr. Tippett also had a fair amount of testimony where, based on Mr. Edwards' history of trauma and her provisional diagnosis of that post-traumatic stress disorder, a lot of the issues that he presents with, in her opinion, may likely be as a result of his trauma history, not necessarily a sexuality history. And so I think it really, actually, when you look at that testimony, they're talking about, all three of the examiners are talking about a lot of the same aspects. They're just calling it something different.
One question that I have is whether it's appropriate to give deference to the panel, not only because, as a finder of fact, it's seeing the witness and hearing the witness firsthand, but also because this is its reason for being, its area of expertise, where we might see one of these cases every couple of months. This is all the panel does in its various compositions. Does that justify, in a close case, deferring to the panel's assessment in the sense that, well, they can compare one case to the other and they've heard the experts, they have a better understanding of the subject matter?
I believe that it does, Your Honor. It's
sort of like agency expertise.
Absolutely. It's a very specialized court, and it's interesting. Mr. Basie and I are working on an appeal in a different case regarding a similar issue, and that's my argument in that case. This is a specialized panel. This is the only thing that they do. They hear from essentially the same witnesses about the same testimony, the same program, the same process.
Same test.
Same everything, every single case. They have specialized knowledge, and I think what we do is we entrust the court to use its experience and knowledge to render decisions based on their area of expertise. Yes, they're bound by the record. They're not allowed to do fact-finding and go out and do independent investigation, but they're a specialized court.
It's sort of like reviewing a sentencing decision. If we're looking at departures, we as a collective body of judges use our experience about what is and is not an appropriate sentence. But this seems a little different because that panel has much more knowledge than any three judges of this court regarding what's appropriate in these cases, just given the number of cases. I mean, presumably they see lots of cases that we never see because they're not appealed.
Certainly, certainly. And I think a point that you made earlier, or a question that you'd asked earlier, these, especially in the case of transfer, this isn't a cut and dry where are these five factors met? Check the box, yes or no. This is so vague and gray with, is this appropriate?
And how does the transfer standard differ from the provisional discharge standard? Is the provisional discharge standard a little more concrete in terms of findings that must be made, or is it?
I wouldn't say in terms of findings that must be made. The language, I believe, is similar as far as the statute's concerned. The panel must consider the following factors. The difference being for a transfer, it's the civilly committed person's burden of proof and production by preponderance of the evidence that transfer is appropriate. On provisional discharge and full discharge, it's the commissioner's burden to prove by clear and convincing evidence that both are not appropriate. So you have different evidentiary burdens and thresholds to prove.
Does it make sense that we would say, well, when we're reviewing whether or not someone meets the standard for commitment as SPP, SDP, that's de novo, that's what the Supreme Court has said, but when we're reviewing whether someone should be granted a petition for a reduction of custody, the review is not de novo? Is there a reason to have different standards?
I think there is for that very reason. When you have the initial SDP, SPP commitment, those three factors must be present. If any one of them is not proven by clear and convincing evidence,
there's
the
no
person
discretion.
Cannot be committed.
Okay.
There's no discretion there. And in this case, because the statute says the panel must consider, you know, it doesn't say that no one
must
factor,
transfer if.
Right, okay. Right. And no one factor is more determinative than the other. So the court, the panel in its authority can say, from a treatment perspective, you know, he needs to be in CPS, but from a risk perspective, we just feel that this individual is way too high and public safety can't justify that, so we're denying. You know, the panel is free to disregard. They have to consider, but ultimately they're not required to say all five factors are present, therefore transfer is appropriate. And I think that's distinguishable between this and an initial civil commitment. The only other, the other point that I would make is that, you know, when we look at some of the specific factual arguments that the commissioner is making in this case, those are points that were all raised during the trial. The commissioner argued those to the panel. The panel obviously rejected those in granting the transfer. Those were also points that were used to try to cross-examine and impeach Dr. Tippett's opinion. She held consistent in her opinion, did not waver, did not falter, did not change her opinion. So I think when you're looking at all the arguments, this really is just trying to get another bite at the apple, asking this court to reweigh the evidence and make a different determination than what the panel did. As far as sufficiency of the findings, I think that the court did enough. The panel's order is sufficient. Again, even if a different outcome could have been reached, that's irrelevant from my position. The court identified the relevant aspects of each of the witnesses' testimony and then clearly in findings 34 and 35 found that Dr. Tippett's opinion was supported, was the most persuasive to the panel. Those findings are supported by the facts in the record as a whole. And I don't believe that Dr. Tippett's opinion was inconsistent, but even if it was, I just received an order in a different case of mine from this court last week. Some inconsistencies in an examiner's opinion doesn't mean that the order overall is insufficiently particular, and that was in the in re the civil commitment of Grauberger, which was court file A18 2023-1790.
Did Dr. Tibbetts meet with Mr. Edwards?
She did.
She did.
Yep.
And as did Dr. Kenning. So it's not as if, as between Dr. Kenning or Dr. Tibbetts, one had more experience with him than the other.
No, not from my recollection. Both had the opportunity to interview Mr. Edwards. Both had the opportunity to review records, wrote reports, and testified.
So then the other expert would be the treatment team or the representative of the treatment team who says, we're
correct.
Working with him. We don't think he's ready to go.
And Mr. Puffer is clinical, well, what MSOP calls clinical leadership. So he's not directly involved. He's not part of the treatment team. He's basically an admin, a higher up, a supervisor of the treatment team.
Well, I'm assuming they do that so we don't have damaged relationships between
correct.
The patients and their treatment
correct.
Providers because the providers are testifying against them at the hearing.
Absolutely.
But
absolutely.
Mr. Puffer, then, his opinion is supposed to represent the
correct.
Opinion of the people that are working with the patients.
Correct, yes. Yeah. So Mr. Puffer doesn't have, for those exact reasons, Mr. Puffer doesn't interview or do the extensive record review. There's a different individual that writes the body of that report that conducts that review, and then Mr. Puffer provides the, you know, bigger picture opinion of the leadership team for those exact reasons. So for all of these reasons, we are asking that this court affirm the panel's decision granting Mr. Edwards transfer. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd just like to start my rebuttal by just reiterating that it is the commissioner's opinion that it is a de novo review of the application of statutory criteria to the facts found. You know, this was reiterated. It's been reiterated time and time again by this court in both published and unpublished decisions.
Well, it's been reiterated in the sense that this court has said in a handful of opinions in the past couple of years, application of statutory standard to facts is reviewed de novo. But that's on the heel of years of case law in which the Supreme Court and this court in published opinions has said, we don't engage in de novo review. We review the record for clear error, asking whether the record as a whole supports the decision. So that there is sort of a conflict in law, or at least the interjection of a standard review that's used in other contexts, and maybe a little confusion caused by that language.
And I think that this court has raised some interesting questions today. There's a question to my opposing counsel about whether there should be a different standard for initial commitments versus reductions in custody, whether, and I think, to be quite frank, Your Honor, I mean, this issue was just not something raised in this appeal in the sense of something that either party had any opportunity or reason to brief. It wasn't something that was really...
I understand that, but you're relying on an unpublished decision for your statement that our review is de novo, and unpublished decisions aren't precedential, they're not binding.
Your Honor, that's, with respect, that's not correct. We're relying on the Crop. Crop is a case that is
in
a published
Crop,
decision.
This court first said, relying on Johnson, we review for clear error. We ask whether the record as a whole supports the decision. Then later in the same paragraph, we said if it's an issue of statutory interpretation or application of statute to facts found, we review de novo. I don't see anywhere in the Crop decision where this court was confronted with and dealt with those two inconsistent statements. And I don't see that in the Crop decision, and you could correct me if I'm wrong, that the Crop court actually said we're engaging in de novo review. We're going to look at the facts that are correct and decide without regard for the panel's decision whether or not to grant relief. So I appreciate what you're saying. The language is there, but I don't see that this court has ever actually engaged in de novo review. I mean, in fact, last month in Anderson, we released an opinion, unpublished again, where we don't mention that application of statutory standard to facts. We went with we review the record for clear error. If the evidence as a whole supports the decision, we defer to the panel because we've got to rely on their, or we've got to defer to their assessment of the competing expert testimony.
I guess with respect, I don't think that that's inconsistent in the sense of that we're looking at, if we review the facts for clear error and we get rid of those facts, and then if there aren't facts in the record that support these factors that this court is...
We would reverse, but then we would do so because the record as a whole does not support the decision. But earlier, Judge Ross asked you, what if you get rid of all the fact findings that are erroneous, and you're left with some facts that would support the grant of relief, some facts that would not? What is this court to do? And your response, I believe, was, well, in that situation, you'd have to affirm. That's not de novo review. De novo review is, well, there are some facts supporting it, some facts not supporting relief. We don't care what the panel did. We're not going to defer to the panel's decision-making or reasoning. We're simply going to decide de novo whether there should be relief. I mean, do you see any court in any case engaging in that sort of analysis when it comes to review of a petition for a reduction of custody?
Your Honor, I guess I personally am not aware at this moment. I haven't actually, you know, I had no reason to delve into the case law for that specific reason because that issue just wasn't part of the briefing. And so I'm happy to do that for the court if the court would prefer post-argument briefing on this very unique issue that's come up in the court that the court spent, you know, the majority of, this oral argument discussing.
Can we go back to the merits? Is there any evidence in the record that aside from Mr. Edwards' maybe not so charming personality, that he's engaged in any, you know, physically abusive or aggressive behavior in the treatment facility?
Yes, Your Honor. We cited in our brief there was an incident in I think 2016 where Mr. Edwards received a BER, which is a behavioral expectation report, a citation kind of thing in MSOP for punching another peer repeatedly in the abdomen. I can provide a citation for that if you'd like, Your Honor.
That was 2016?
Correct, Your Honor. We discussed that on page 3. I'm sorry, not 3. Page 5 of our initial brief. I'm sorry, page 6. And it's exhibit 19 of the underlying briefing or record, Your Honor. But there's been other indications where he may not have, you know, physically beat somebody, but there's been a lot of examples
of
him.
Lack of control.
Lack of control, correct, Your Honor. And I see I'm out of time, Your Honor, and with respect, you know, appellant will rely on their briefing in this case and respectfully request that the court reverse the decision. And again, the commissioner is happy to provide post-hearing briefing on this issue if the court would like it as far as what the proper standard of review is as far as...
We will let you know.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Don't submit it without invitation.
Of course. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you both for your arguments. The matter is submitted.